Hi, you're watching a very special recording of Agenda Wani. When I'm outside the studio, that means I have great people that I'm chasing just to get the thoughts in for me to share with you on Agenda Wani. And today I must thank EPF. They have this cool thing, ISWC 2019. You know, looking at the well-being, it's an international conference. There's a lot of new ideas and old ideas given a new life. There was even a great debate. I was missing out because I think I should have been the moderator. But never mind, I managed to, you know, steal one speaker out. Melina Rydell, thank you so much for making time.
Thank you.
You were like many of us here in Malaysia, you know, a corporate slave before. But after 18 years, you said, no more, I'm going to do my own stuff. And you wrote a book and you have written books since then. But it's the central theme that many Malaysians will be interested about. Because there's many of us who, you know, wake up early in the morning, brave the traffic jam, settle the family needs, work more than 9 hours because we're told in our upbringing that we must be a good worker, you know. Study hard, get good grades, work in a good job and do well. But suddenly, we started seeing, because of internet and technology, there's this country called Bhutan and they're the happiest person in the world. Where's the white-collar worker in that particular country? And then, of course, every time we look at that northern part of Europe, where your home country is, you know, the Scandinavians, as we like to call it over here, the Danes and the Swedes and the Finnish people, and the Icelandic too, and they're even getting better at football now. And we're like, why are they every time top of the ranking in everything, even happiness? So I'm going to take happiness because you started your writing career on that. But one thing I want to take out from what you wrote is trust. It's so easy to say this word trust. Mm. But like your co-speaker Chandra said, even if you ask who can be trusted and they put up their hand, would you trust them? So, you know, to me that was kind of an oxymoron. But in Asia, sometimes trust is everything because it's ingrained into our culture. Mm. Respect the elderly, yeah. Don't raise your voice, disagree in a nice way. Mm. But the modern world is different. Chandran talked about the post-Western modernity. And you are from the West, but you relocated from Denmark to Paris in France. Mm. So I guess you're the best person to ask about all this. I'm sorry I made the preamble a bit long, but I just want to paint the context of where we're getting here.
Well, I mean, again, and I understand, you know, I come from far away, from a small country. I come from a different culture, you would even say, in a homogeneous country. We don't have all the different cultural influences and religions that you have, for instance, in Malaysia. So the base and the conditions for the way you live is very different from the example. And I often ask people, can you look at this just as a case study or an example? Because I think the inspiration of why is it that the Scandinavian countries and Denmark, as an example, come out at the top? And one of the reasons, and you raised this word, one of the ingredients or one of the pillars is really trust. So Denmark has the highest level of trust in the world. They have a level of trust in between people, so people you don't know, the other person in the street, at 78%. So 8 out of 10 Danes trust somebody they have never met before. And actually, the trust level in institutions is even higher. It's at 84%. Yeah. So that explains, hence, also the willingness of Danish people to pay taxes. 100% of the working population pay taxes. I think in Malaysia it's around 10%.
Very small, yeah.
So there's a high engagement in this collective common project that people feel individually responsible of. So when you have, Denmark is also one of the lowest, has one of the lowest corruption levels in the world, actually the lowest.
Yeah.
So all of that explains why, and the relationship with the institutions is when you have very low corruption and you have a sense of a collective project, you create this in terms of trust in society, in institutions, etc. Now, when you're in a country where the level of trust is low, so how does, you would say, how does that relate to me? Basically, today I live in Malaysia. You say trust is a good thing. We all know it is because we know the feeling of
yes.
it. And we certainly know the feeling of distrust, mm-hmm. which makes us, generally speaking, unhappy.
Correct.
If you look over your shoulder and you meet new people and you think, like, I can't trust that person. Mm-hmm. And so what I encourage, and the reason why I asked the question in front of the crowd, and I said, do you consider yourself to be a trustworthy person? And in reality, what does that mean? If you raise your hand and say, yeah, no, I can be trusted, what does that mean exactly, and what are the rules? Does that mean you don't steal, or does it mean, and are you still a trustworthy person if you cheat a little bit with the taxes and the government, mm-hmm. or is it 100%? Mm-hmm. And I often say, maybe I shouldn't say this on TV, but you know, I raise my hand willingly, and people probably believe me because I come from Denmark.
Okay.
But at the same time, I have employed in my home in France an illegal immigrant for more than 2 years, and I'm helping her to get her papers, but that's illegal, so I'm breaking the law. Am I still a trustworthy person? Mm-hmm. We're about at the end of the week now. I have maybe lied 4 times saying to people that wrote me emails if I could participate in a debate, and I said, okay. No, I can't do that, but actually I didn't want to. And so, you know, how do you build this and how do you look at it? And also the other point is, how willing are you as an individual to take that risk when you build it? Because when you build trust, and so I come from a country with, let's say, 80% trust, yeah?
Okay.
I moved to France, they have 20. France only has 20% trust.
Okay.
It's a very distrustful nation,
country.
And so, yet I believe that my individual level of trust in France today is above 80%. Because I make sure that my behavior is consistent, so what I do is what I say, and what I say is what I do, And I take that risk every day of extending my trust to somebody else.
Okay.
Now, will I do it like in Denmark, put babies in streets and jackets and bags? No, I won't. But I will, and I'll also do it in Malaysia, I will reach out to any person in the street that come across my path, and I'll look at them, and I'll try to make that human connection. And I often touch people physically, and I say, if I had an emergency in the street in Malaysia and I had to run off somewhere, I would engage with the person and look at them and say, can you watch my stuff? I need to run somewhere to I have an emergency. Can I trust you? They might run away. But when I say 80% in Denmark, I also say 20% don't work. Mm-hmm. And this is a choice we have to make every day. Do you choose to take that risk, whether it's a big risk because the level of trust is low, but every time you build it, you participate in building more trust in the society, because the person that will live that moment with you would want to engage more in this. And so I think we need to scale down and scale it down to ourselves. And how do we act? What is it that we build as individuals around us? What kind of community are you building? What kind of community am I building? And how do I relate to this responsibility of being a citizen of the world and building this kind of relationship with other people?
Okay.
And for me, of course, and this is obvious, that the more corruption you have in a country, the more people will allow themselves to align to the lowest denominator of he cheated, so will I.
Okay.
But that's... It comes down again to considering ourselves as changers of the world as individuals. Mm-hmm. And so do you want to align with that guy, or you want to look like the change you would actually like to see in the world?
Okay.
So that's how it's more of a universal view than really a Danish view, because I don't even live in Denmark anymore.
Correct. So before I go to the world, I still want to deconstruct this Danish thing anyway. By the way, I love Denmark. Your tennis player, your football player, Daniel Egger, one of the best centre-back for Liverpool ever. But what's the secret? Is it the Viking DNA? You know, people here, because of Netflix and everything else, they keep looking at dramas that we wouldn't have ever seen before. But popular culture also sometimes distorts understanding of real stuff. So getting it from you, since you were small, what has been the secret of having this high level of trust in Denmark as compared to anywhere else in the world? Is it inherited? Is it a ritual that's over centuries? Is it just the way the community is set up? What is it?
We only have data that goes back about 45 years, so we don't know what the levels of trust were before, to be honest. You know, some people say, oh, the Vikings, they trusted the people that they sent out in the countries that they conquered. We don't know that much about it. And did they do as they were told to do because they're afraid that their heads were going to get cut off? I don't, you know, we don't know in reality. Yeah. What we do know is that when we track back, you could see some of the first anti-corruption laws being placed in Denmark. Denmark is a kingdom. And so at that time, I think it was in the 16th century, the first anti-corruption laws of nepotism and actually bribing people were noticed in the Danish history. And so that's early on, and we've always had relatively low levels of corruption in Denmark. When we went bankrupt, there was a time when the state went bankrupt, there was a high level of corruption, and then it's actually been stably low since then. But then, again, because we don't have solid data to show it, but I think an interesting point of view could also be when you go back in history, there is a personality in the Danish history that's actually important to understand. It's a man called, it's a pastor called Grundtvig. Grundtvig created in Denmark. He was part of he was one of the men that stood behind the Danish constitution, but he also, in the 19th century, he opened one of the first schools, what we call Højskole. It's sort of a school of life, and we still have these schools. He said, why is it that we teach children to be good at math and chemics and you know, Latin, but we don't teach children how to be good at being human beings, how to be good at being together, and what does it mean anyway to be Danish? And so he created these schools where he educated people in building communities, in the individual responsibility of being a Danish citizen. And so what does it mean to actually live together in a community, and how do we build that? And so these schools, you still have them today, high school in the Danish education, they started opening them up in Korea now, where we teach other things than just the intellectual matters. And I think the fact that the Danish educational system focuses on valuing all talents equally, it focuses on developing the personality of the child. So they encourage trust in yourself.
The individual matters?
The individual trusting yourself to be good enough. And when you have that as a starting point and you're taught at school that you're good enough, that your talent, if it's manual, mechanic, sports, music, is just as good and needed in the society as anybody who has intellectual competences, then we start having a shared view of actually not tolerating each other, as the gentleman said just earlier, but actually accepting and appreciating, embracing everyone in this. And again, I understand that you have different cultural influences, but even furthermore, you should do this because it needs much more understanding, empathy. We teach children empathy at the age of 6 years old to actually be able to identify your own emotions and values and to understand and receive those of others. Understanding, and I think understanding actually is a very helpful tool in building trust.
Yes.
Because if I don't understand you, I probably won't trust you. But if I try to understand you, you're sitting here interviewing me, I trust you.
I trust
that you will ask me fair questions, that you won't try to trick me. And I walk into the interview feeling like this. And I think it's I've spent time since I arrived, I haven't been here for that long, but trying to understand what is it that goes on in your country, and what are the values, and what are the things that I find surprising, different, threatening maybe. And why is it that I find them that way? Because it all comes from me. And that's what we need to understand, that the way you view the world has everything to do with yourself and very little to do with the world.
Cool. I have to go for the first and last break, but once we are back, I trust you enough to ask you the bigger question now. the world, sadly, seems to be going the opposite side of trust. Yeah. The greatest economy and biggest superpower in the world are building walls at their borders, making it harder for people from outside to come in. When what I understand when I was studying history was nearly 9 out of 10 successful businesses in America have migrant roots because of the history of that country. And not only there, but if we move back to the East, we're seeing riots on the streets of disagreement between shared prosperity and how countries are being ruled. The younger population are speaking out, not just speaking, they're going on the street, demonstrating what they think should be and should not be. So how can we still go out to the world with trust when the ecosystem is a bit more challenged as far as trust is concerned? We will ask Melina right after this short break. If you believe certain things online, the world is on fire. It's on fire because there's a breakdown of trust between countries, inside the country, between population and communities, between rival economic interests. However, there's also good things to look at. People are rallying to speak about wanting a better world. A 16-year-old, surprise, surprise, came from that northern side of Europe. She's willing to take on a small yacht just to cross the Atlantic to go and school all the top powerful leaders of the world in New York. Imagine that. Here in Asia, if we say, never mind, you're 16-year-old, stay in school. Wait until maybe you're 21 and then go and do that. So the world is changing. There's a lot more fear, however, about where the world's going. So since you have written and you've spoken just now even to us about happiness and the element, the pillar of trust for that happiness, how do we carry that internationally? You've done that from Denmark to France, but how do we do that collectively around the world? Because the world needs this.
I think, you know, and I agree with you that what we're seeing is definitely not making us believe that that's where we're heading in terms of how people vote in countries. And even to a certain extent, we see also extreme right-wing gaining a certain level of power in the Scandinavian countries, and we see generally over Europe nationalism and the fear of the other person, of somebody who's different. We're starting to, let's say that some of the conditions that you have here, because you have all these communities, we're starting to see that same thing. So somebody who's different is feared. Yeah, the Americans don't want the Mexicans to come in, or the Danish people are afraid of the immigrants from some certain Arab or African countries, and so. The fear of the other, and what is lacking when we feel that way about the other person, it's we lack empathy. We don't connect as human beings. And you know, it might you might consider that that's a very naive way to approach it, but I think there are three ways to change the world, more or less, yeah? So you can rely on politicians to do it for us.
Okay.
So we all, if we live in a democratic country, we'll go and vote. Yeah, so that's how we participate, and we lay our trust, in a certain sense, in someone else who is supposed to do this for us.
Yes.
Okay, that's one way of changing the world. It seems to me that it takes a lot of time,
yes,
and sometimes it doesn't work. The other way of changing the world is through corporations. So companies can actually influence the way we conduct our societies, the way we do business, the way we treat the employees, what we educate them to be within the company. So when we foster trust, empathy, a sense of purpose, having equal pay systems, paying people well, making sure they have retirement, etc., that's a different way of trying to influence. And actually, corporations today, as we see them, can actually influence the politicians. Yeah.
Okay.
So to a certain extent, they have realized, if I take the example of Korea, where I've traveled a lot, in Korea, to a certain extent, that they went for the inspiration of the French educational system being the elite system. Mm-hmm. We value those who are intellectually best. And so you push people to just win. You just want to win and be the best. And so that doesn't create happiness in any version of it, not even for the ones that win. They get a little kick, but how do you stay at the top? You can't always stay at the top. And if you always want to win, then it basically means that everyone else is losing. And so they realize now, by having high suicidal rates in youth, they have people killing themselves at school because they can't keep up with it. And they also have admitted that there's something that doesn't work, because when we had the big scandal at Samsung with the phone, you know, people knew, they just didn't dare to say so because they're educated that way, that they couldn't talk about it. And so hence they are now encouraging the educational system to change. So through what companies ask for in terms of competences, that's a different way. And then this, the third way, which is my preferred way, is it's us. And it's each individual of us. What is it that we choose to do and be and incarnate in this project called the world, or called our society, or called the world we live in? How do we behave towards the other person? How much time do we actually spend on judging other people being wrong, or not having the right behavior, or distrusting them, and why? What's your starting point? Mm-hmm. And what are your filters when you read other people? How do I, when I arrive in Malaysia, I have a set of values that I come with, and that set of values will give me a filter of how I view other people. And we need to be responsible of those filters and understand that most of what we see reflects ourselves. And so when I walk in the street and I judge this and that person to be arrogant or distrustful, what is it within me that makes me view it that way? And could I view it maybe a little bit differently? What am I so afraid of? What am I so afraid of? And I think building these bridges between people and being that person actually at the table, at your dinner, voicing it. If you hear racist comments, voice it. Ask questions. Have you never seen examples of it being different? You don't like the Indian people? You don't like the Chinese people? You don't like the Muslim people? And actually try to build bridges around us. I mean, I call it empathy, because I think understanding is what? What is it that makes the American, or part of the American people, say they don't want the Mexicans? I mean, again, then they make these scary campaigns that they steal and they do crimes and they kill people. Yeah, and that's what they use, all the nationalists, they use these kind of techniques to scare people. Because it's what, it's fear.
Yeah.
It's fear of the other human being. And so I do think we have a role to play in these situations. When we had the situation in France, when we had the terrorist attacks in 2015, and it's still going on, I refuse to sit at a table and not bridge when somebody says, oh, Islam, or oh, this and that. I have many Muslim friends all over the world, and I connect with these people, I trust these people, and they're my friends. And so I refuse to just sit down and not build the bridge and not make the other example. And I think if we all try to do that just a little bit, and I know in Asia you're not exactly educated to voice your opinion. We are in the Scandinavian countries. No, but we are. Yeah. And so at school, when we read a text, a book, they don't ask us to learn by heart what was in the book. They ask you what did you think of the book? And so we're educated very early on to have an opinion, and for that opinion to matter. And it's actually not about the opinion being right or wrong. It's about being able to voice it.
Express it.
Express it. And so I think just a little bit, trying to bridge, create more understanding instead of like creating more conflict. Don't go with the flow of saying, oh yeah, this community stereotyping, oh this kind of, oh, somebody said, oh the Chinese will cheat us, or oh the Indians will do this, or the Muslims will do this. Just try to bridge and just think of how we could look at it differently. And would they always do that? No, they won't always do that, yeah? And why do you think they will do that? And you know, actually, there's something really interesting about how we live as individuals.
Okay.
What you believe, what you profoundly believe, you'll find the means to make that happen. So if you believe that people will cheat you, if you believe that the world is a bad place, if you believe that you can't trust anybody, you're gonna find proof and you're gonna make that happen. No worries. If you believe on the contrary, that you can trust people and we can make it work, and actually that the communities have all have good things to add into the common project, let's call the common project Malaysia.
Okay.
If you believe this, this is what you're gonna start creating. The way the brain works is that we get around 400 million pieces of information per day.
Okay.
400 millions of pieces
big
of
data,
information.
Okay.
So big data. So nobody can, you know, we can't process that much. So there's a sort of a filter or a GPS that selects information that we get. That filter selects only 2,000 pieces of information that we get out of 400 million. The information that we register consciously is selected based on your general beliefs and the general path that you have in your life, yeah? So if you believe something, the 2,000 pieces of information that are sent down are proof to what you already believe. And so out of 400 million possibilities, you only get the information that proves that you're right. So be careful of what you believe, what you think of other people, because mm-hmm. you're gonna select. You know when somebody comes to me and they say, oh, my boss, he's a really arrogant person, mm-hmm. and you know, I can't trust him. They come with a list of proofs that's that long. Because that's what people do. They collect proofs in being right in what they think already. And so that's how we create extreme opinions. Extremism comes from that we're collecting proof
yes.
about the other person
one
being wrong.
Yeah.
And so just think about, sit down and think about, what are your general beliefs about the world, about people? Because what is going to happen is you're going to produce more of that.
Okay. Wow. And
wow.
I haven't
sorry.
Even gone to the sex, material, money, and never mind, you have to come back. But I don't want to leave you before. I want to ask you this one final thing. I know it's not a full in-depth research, but you've seen Malaysia now, and you're lucky enough to be at this social well-being conference
yeah.
where you see the representation of Malaysian voices,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so what's your opinion now of us, and what's your best advice? Because we would like to get closer to Bhutan and Denmark and being happy in the World Happiness Index, but the fact is we're rather closer to the number 100 rather than number one. So what would you say?
I think that, if I may say so.
By all means.
I think you guys need to create a more egalitarian system here. And
okay.
I think you need to create a welfare system where you provide retirement for people, you provide security for people,
mm-hmm.
unemployment, and basically making more than 10% of the population pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
You can't solve this if you don't have people
coming together
and considering this is actually
mm-hmm.
a common project
yep.
for all of you.
Okay.
And it's welfare, the welfare state,
mm-hmm.
it does, it's not a fantasy, it exists, but
yep.
it requires
in its work, yeah.
it actually requires that you pay taxes and that you're willing to
share.
Put in
yeah.
and share, and you might pay a little bit more
mm-hmm.
than somebody else, but the fact that there's one of the chapters in my book that's called I feel when you're good I feel better
mm-hmm. okay
because it's actually this feeling of justice, social justice,
mm-hmm.
equal opportunities. And and taxes is a necessary thing to that. And I was, when I moved to France, my bank called me up one day and said, oh, Ms. Rydell, oh, you need to come to the bank. There's a big problem. I said, oh, what's happening? She said, you're paying way too much tax. And I said, do I? That's interesting. I mean, my income is quite simple, and so I pay tax according to that, no? She said, come to the office and come to the bank. So I went to the bank, and I said, what's wrong? And she said, listen, I have this thing. You can invest in real estate somewhere in Ile de la Réunion, and then you'll pay no tax. It's really great. And I said, I have no interest of paying no tax. I want to pay tax. I want to participate in the society I live in. I understand that if you feel that certain instances in your government are corrupt, etc., you say, like, I don't want to give you my money. But where does it start, the chicken or the egg? I mean, where? What's the starting point?
For today, start with a very lovely, blonde, Scandinavian lady now residing in Paris. Thank you so much. I want to tell my mother that I should go for blonde, but she said, no,
we're in Malaysia. Don't do that.
Thank you so much.
No,
thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you for listening to me. Thank
if
you.
If I don't take anything else thank from you, you I'm going to say this to the audience. Start thinking that paying tax is making our society better rather than running away from the tax man. All the other processes that comes with it, whether they are doing it right or well, is also a collective responsibility, because we now hold power. We have the new Malaysia. Where the new Malaysia leads is in our hands. Thank you so much, Melina Rydell, for making time. Thanks to you for watching a very special recording of Agenda Wani, and thanks to EPF for allowing this to happen. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.